This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington.
Houston, tranquility base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
50 years ago, the world held its breath as Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin became the first men on the moon. The Apollo 11 mission advanced America in the space race against the Soviet Union. It took more than 400,000 people across the country to bring that mission together, including one who fought popular opinion on how to conduct the mission. Had he failed, Aldrin and Armstrong would not have gotten ticker tape parades. They would have gotten memorials. This radical engineer who made Apollo 11 work is the subject of a new audiobook called The Man Who Knew the Way to the Moon. Joining us in studio is the author of that audiobook, Todd Zwillick, who is a frequent fill-in host here on the program. Todd, welcome back to 1A.
Great to be here, and a little weird to be on this side of the table, but I like it.
You know, every now and then, we just want to shake it up a little bit. Before we talk about who this guy was, set the scene for us. Apollo 11 blasted off in 1969. Your story covers a lot of what happened leading up to that. Remind us what was going on in the U.S. and kind of what NASA was before Apollo 11.
And this story starts really in 1960, if you like. 1960 is a good place to start. You could start with Sputnik and the space race if you wanted. But John Hobolt's story really starts in 1960, before Yuri Gagarin had ever been to space, before Alan Shepard had ever been to space. So these engineers in the back rooms of NASA, because they're aerospace engineers, thinking about, you know, we're probably going to go to the moon one day. This is something we're going to want to do. How might we want to do that? What's the best ways to do that? Debates are raging. John Hobolt is there. He wasn't an aerospace engineer. He wasn't a space guy. He was an airplane engineer. So he was an outsider in these debates. He was kind of allowed in because in those days, the Russians had beat us with Sputnik and everyone was looking for good ideas. If you can make a calculation, if you can make a suggestion, you can definitely be in the room, but he was an outsider. So the reason why John's early ideas challenged so many people was that they hadn't even decided that they wanted to go to the moon. This is, we're talking 2 years before that famous speech, before John Kennedy got in front of the nation and said, I believe we should go to the moon, you know, way before that.
Speaking of that famous speech, let's hear from that better known John, President John F. Kennedy. Here's what he said before Congress in the spring of 1961.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish.
That was President Kennedy speaking to Congress in the spring of 1961, and after that speech, Todd, it kind of catalyzed the country, not just NASA, but the whole country in a brand new way.
Sure did. Look what happened in the weeks before this speech. Alan Shepard had just gone into space. It was really only 2 weeks. Alan Shepard becomes the first American to orbit. Kennedy goes, gosh, the public loves him. Look at the public response. The U.S. is on the board now. I want a way to get us to leapfrog past the Russians. That story gets told a lot, that Kennedy made his advisors bear down and say, how can we leap past the Russians? In John's world, it was fascinating. He had already spent more than a year fighting, campaigning. And at times, this campaign, I want to tell you, was really ugly. When John Hobolt was behind the scenes at NASA trying to convince his colleagues and leaders and other engineers that his concept for a moon mission was really the only way to do it, not only was he ignored sometimes, Joshua, not only was he maligned at times, sometimes he was downright abused. It's really surprising. That's all going on behind the scenes. All these fights over theories, when Kennedy made that speech, wait a second, these aren't theories anymore. Now this is policy. All of a sudden, the theoretical has to become real. We have to figure out how to get to the moon, and we have to figure it out quick. By the end of the decade is 8.5 years from the spring of 61. We don't have time. And that starts to solidify and galvanize everyone's thinking to say, we need to get serious about how we're actually going to do this. Last thing I'll tell you that's amazing. When Kennedy made that speech, you know how much experience we had in manned spaceflight in this country? 5 minutes. Alan Shepard's flight was 5 minutes. Kennedy gets in front of the world and says, we're going to the moon. At NASA, they go, we are. 5 minutes experience. So they had to get real serious real fast.
We're speaking to Todd Zwillick, the author of the new audiobook, The Man Who Knew the Way to the Moon. We'd love your questions and thoughts about this and your recollections of Apollo 11. What did it mean to you 50 years ago to see that the Eagle had landed? Email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page or tweet us at 1A. Let's talk more, Todd, about this guy, John Hobolt. Can you give us a bit of his backstory, how he got to NASA?
Yeah, he was a civil engineer. John Hobolt was a poor kid, and I mean a really poor kid. His parents were tenant farmers. Then they were servants in central Illinois. He came from Joliet, which is south of Chicago, grew up working on a farm, which he hated. He absolutely hated being on the farm, his wife, Mary, told me, and other family members told me. So he went to work. He got a free education. He went to junior college in Joliet. He got a scholarship to the University of Illinois. He got a Rockefeller Fellowship to get a PhD in Zurich. This is a guy who worked hard for every little bit of advancement he could get. He really had nothing handed to him. And that became a factor in his life, I think, later when he was rubbing shoulders with Ivy League engineers and privileged people and people who didn't respect him. It really got under his skin. And I think that's part of the reason why. But John came to NASA before it was NASA. Before NASA, it was called NACA. It had a different acronym.
It's like the National Advisory Council for Aeronautics or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And this was mostly airplanes and missiles. Nobody had been to space yet, so they didn't have the space part. After Sputnik, they sure got the space part under Eisenhower. So John came to NACA in the immediate post-war period. That's when he met his wife, Mary, who, by the way, a fascinating figure in this story, and a figure she is. Mary Morris met John Hobolt at NASA Langley Research Center in Hampton, Virginia, still exists. She was a human computer, just like the Hidden Figures. In fact, in the same operation as the Hidden Figures a few years before. She did not know them, but she was one of the mathematical wizard women who calculated trajectories and airplane mathematics.
And just to be clear, when we say human computers, for those who didn't say Hidden Figures, yeah, we're talking about a core of women who worked at NASA who basically did what at the time was considered the grunt work of raw arithmetic. The engineers would say, here's a stack of equations, solve these and bring the answers back. And so these women would just work in rooms just doing math all day.
And they didn't have computers to help them. And Mary had a math degree from University of North Carolina. She was a brilliant mathematical mind. It's very interesting to think about the what ifs of a different time. Mary could have easily been the center of this story had she gone that route.
There's a scientific term that we need to explain before we keep going that's central to what John Hobolt advocated: lunar orbit rendezvous, or LOR. This was one of three approaches that kind of made the finals at NASA in terms of how to do Apollo 11. Before we explain what lunar orbit rendezvous is, what were the other two ideas?
There are two main ideas, and some of the ideas that were flying around NASA at the time are fascinatingly hilarious. You think, God, if we had tried to go to the moon like this. The first one will remind you of maybe old movies from the 20s that you've seen of moon fantasies. Launch a big rocket and back it down butt first onto the moon. Just go directly there, land that big rocket butt first. They really considered it, and they considered it strongly. That's called direct ascent. Ascend directly to the moon, land that big rocket right on the moon. The second major competing concept was called Earth Orbit Rendezvous. This is kind of like 2001 Space Odyssey. Launch pieces of a spacecraft into Earth orbit, rendezvous them, assemble a moon vehicle up there in orbit, send that vehicle to the moon, and again, just like the direct ascent mode, land a big rocket butt first on the moon, explore, launch, come back. John was the guy who said, neither of these things are going to work, and I have a million reasons why, from development to mass to fuel to safety of the astronauts. This is when John started to rattle the cages around NASA to tell people those aren't going to work.
And if I'm not mistaken, the direct descent idea, the one where you basically kind of pull out of your driveway, go to someone else's house, and back right in to their garage, required a rocket that was so big and it would have required so much fuel that it would have been an engineering feat to even build something that big that could fly at all.
This was part of the problem. That rocket would have been called the Nova. And there were lots of people around NASA, including the most powerful people at NASA. People like Wernher von Braun, the father of the V-2 rocket, came to work for the United States. He wanted direct ascent. He wanted the big Nova. John was the outsider, convincing people it'll never work. Not only will you never get it built, but try to land that thing on the moon. It's going to be a disaster if you try.
And where did he sit in the hierarchy at NASA? Did he have any pull, or was he just kind of some low-level engineer?
Wasn't even really part of it. If I told you he was low on the hierarchy, that wouldn't even get to it because he wasn't even part of the chain. There was a group at Langley called the Space Task Group. They were the ones launching Mercury, designing it. John worked at Langley. He wasn't part of it. He was off to the side. He was an expert in rendezvous, so they knew he knew how to calculate orbital trajectories. I mean, they knew he knew his engineering, but he was not part of the structure. So he's coming in sideways. That's what he's doing, to blow up the bureaucracy and try to get people to listen.
We'll continue in just a minute with Todd Zwillick. The new audiobook is called The Man Who Knew the Way to the Moon. We've got a clip of John Hobolt to play in a little bit, and we want to get to exactly what it meant for NASA to have him on the team and how that affected NASA thereafter. Glad to get some of your remembrances of Apollo 11. R tweeted, "I remember the first moon landing very clearly. Right after Neil Armstrong spoke his first words, I mentally added, 'The future starts here. I hope humanity doesn't mess it up.'" We'll continue with the story of John Hobolt, and we'll get to some more of your questions and thoughts as well. I'm Joshua Johnson, glad to be with you, and you are listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the Apollo 11 mission and the engineer who made the landing possible with Todd Zwillick. He's the author of the new audiobook, The Man Who Knew the Way to the Moon. We'd love to hear from you, too, your questions, your stories, your thoughts about what Apollo 11 meant to the nation and to the world, maybe your recollections of what happened back in 1969. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. And before we continue, I would like to say hello to WBFO Public Radio in Buffalo, New York. They are taking 1A for the first time this week. Hello, Buffalo. Thank you so much for making us part of your schedule. Please do check out our website, the1a.org, for all the different ways that you can contact us and suggest stories, maybe from the Buffalo area or from any other part of New York, or just what's happening in your neighborhood that you think the nation should be talking about. That's the1a, the word the number one, the letter A, .org. Glad also to get some of your stories about the Apollo missions. Barbara emailed, "My father was a principal investigator for experiments on a number of Apollo missions. As a young high school intern, I got the chance to help him during Apollo 15 by doing some calculations and plotting the results. Each group of scientists had a set of rooms to work in, and when things were slow, they all went to look at each other's work, almost like a science fair. The excitement they had in each other's scientific contributions will always stay with me." Todd Zwillick, I hear where she's coming from in terms of the excitement of Apollo 15. From what you described, Apollo 11 was exciting for much more stressful reasons. Like, this wasn't theoretical science fair. This is, the president has ordered us to succeed.
Yeah, he really has. I mean, you can go to the moment of the landing, which was a big deal for John Hobolt after all of the years of fighting and abuse that he felt he had been through. You can go to the beginning, to Kennedy's speech, when, as I said, the moon challenge comes and all of a sudden these theoretical ideas inside NASA have to get very, very real. And for John Hobolt, this was a time where he wanted to take advantage of an opportunity. When Kennedy made that speech, in John Hobolt's world, for a year and a half, he had already been going to any committee he could, grabbing any engineer he could find, any boss who would pass him in the hallway. He was grabbing people left and right in formal and informal settings and saying, "Lunar orbit rendezvous, this is the mode. This is how we're going to get to the moon." Some people were politely dismissive. Some people ignored him. Some people were downright hostile. And I'll share one story with you to give you a sense of how hostile people could be. December of 1960, long before John F. Kennedy ever made that speech, John Hobolt is in a top-level meeting with all of the top people at NASA, including Wernher von Braun, world-famous engineer, describing different modes to how to get to the moon. They talked about direct descent, which we talked about. They talked about Earth orbit rendezvous, which we talked about. Here comes John Hobolt, talks about rendezvous, talks about lunar orbit rendezvous. Here's how we should go to the moon. Another engineer, a guy named Max Vigée, wound up being famous. Max Vigée helped design the space shuttle. He designed the Mercury capsules. He was young at that time, but a heavy hitter inside NASA, a brilliant engineer. Vigée stands up in this meeting. He pounds his fists on the table. He says, "Don't listen to Hobolt. Don't listen to this. His figures lie." Storms out of the room. He humiliates John. John found this unbelievably humiliating. He talked about it for the rest of his life. I have tape. I have videos of long after John's retirement when he's an old man, still talking about this event. This event stuck with him for the rest of his life. It's emblematic of the way some people treated him in these early days. These were just engineering debates. They got very personal.
Yet he talks about the moment of the Apollo 11 landing, years after this humiliation, after he had to fight for what became the trajectory model for Apollo 11. Here's a clip of John Hobolt from your audiobook, The Man Who Knew the Way to the Moon.
All the people jumped up and started clapping, but at the same time, everybody, because they didn't want to miss a fraction of a second of history being made. Of course, it was very emotional. Tears were in her eyes. And a wonderful thing happened. Von Braun turned to me. And he did this kind of sign. He says, "Thank you, John. It is a good idea."
That's John Hobolt referring to Wernher von Braun from a clip from the audiobook, The Man Who Knew the Way to the Moon. All right. So we've explained the other two methods. What exactly is LOR, Lunar Orbit Rendezvous? What did that involve?
Well, the best way to think about lunar orbit rendezvous, first of all, imagine the moon landing if you can. Most of us can. They remember that lunar module. The little lunar lander with four legs comes down and then a piece of it launches back up. That piece rendezvous with an orbiting mothership, a command module. You go back to Earth. That's lunar orbit rendezvous. If you can't picture it, the simplest way to think about it is if you take a big ship, big cargo ship, ocean liner across the ocean, and you want to go to shore, best not to try to drive that ship right up to the shore. It's not going to work. It's going to be difficult. You're going to hit rocks. You're going to hit tides. Why not park it offshore and take a rowboat into shore to do your business, come back on the rowboat, go back home? That's the concept. That's exactly what lunar orbit rendezvous offers. When you're traveling in space, really two things matter the most: weight and fuel. Every ounce that you take into space, you have to push around with fuel. This is why rockets are so huge. They're all fuel. A big rocket is 90% fuel. You need all that fuel to get anywhere, especially out of orbit. What lunar orbit rendezvous allowed Apollo to do was to get people on the moon in the lightest and simplest way possible. Don't take all of these tens of hundreds of thousands of pounds of fuel down to the surface and then push it all the way home. Park it in orbit, take a little Coke can down to the surface, do your exploring, plant your flag, come back and rendezvous, get home in a much lighter, much simpler, by the way, much cheaper way.
And also the trajectory of the way they got around the Earth and the moon was important, because if they had gotten that wrong, and this is discussed in Hidden Figures in the movie, if they had gotten that wrong, there was the very real possibility that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin could have basically ended up drifting into space and never been able to make it back
to
Earth.
No question. A number of things. I explained to you how maligned John Hobolt was at times by other people when he tried to convince them in the early days why lunar orbit rendezvous was the best. There was groupthink against this. People said, no, direct is it just normal bureaucratic groupthink. This is the way we're going to do it. There was politics. Powerful, famous people like Wernher von Braun wanted the big Nova rocket, wanted the direct ascent. But what you just described, Joshua, was a major part of this. People were terrified of the idea of rendezvous around the moon. 1960, the first time we rendezvoused anything in space, in Earth orbit, was 1966. It wouldn't happen for another 6 years when John got started. And when they tried it, the crew almost died. That pilot was named Neil Armstrong, and his craft in Gemini 8 went into a wild spin that nearly killed him and his co-pilot. So they knew that one day they would want to do Rendezvous. Everybody knew Rendezvous itself, two spacecraft meeting up in orbit, would be a useful thing. But rendezvousing ships around the moon, 250,000 miles away, you only get one chance. If you miss, by the way, you're going 4,000 miles an hour. You know, it's misleading when you see the films. It's a nice slow drift. It looks so graceful. You're going faster than a bullet out of a gun.
It's kind of like being in an airplane where you see the clouds just kind of floating by. You don't realize that you're doing like 480, 500 miles per hour in the air.
Hitting a bullet with a bullet, and these engineers knew the math, and to many of them were just terrified. You're going to do this way out there? We're going to lose these astronauts. We're going to kill them. John responded to that saying, it's not that complicated. I've got the math. I've got the calculations. No, Max Vigée, they don't lie. We can actually do this, and it's not that hard. It's not that complicated, and he showed them how to do that.
Let me get to a few of your thoughts, including your memories of what Apollo 11 meant to you. Eric tweeted, my favorite memory of my father is us watching the moonwalk and then going outside and laying on the back of his Ford Torino and looking at the moon. He told me, see, anything is possible. It changed me forever. Susan wrote on our Facebook page, I've listened to the audiobook four times already. It's fascinating and surprising. It only strengthened my love affair with science and especially space science. Thank you for bringing us this story. Clearly, John Hobel to someone whose name we should know, at least in the story of Apollo 11. Some people refer to him as an unsung hero. Is he really an unsung hero, or is he just the kind of person where if you are not an astrophysicist or follow NASA, you wouldn't know who
This is the kind of question that dogs anyone who worked at NASA, and especially, I think, chases John Hobel's story. Look, he's not unknown. If you go to the Air and Space Museum, there's a little picture of him. If you read all the wonderful books that are coming out of Apollo 11, you'll read about John Hobel, but you'll read one paragraph. You might read a page. He tends to be a footnote in all of the stories of Apollo. Some of this is because most of us only know the astronauts. People can name Neil Armstrong, they can maybe name Buzz. After that, a lot of people don't know any of the names at all. So some of that is natural. The idea of whether John is really an unsung hero is one of the key threads of this story, because once John was involved in these debates, Joshua, he left NASA at the end of 1962. He was so disgusted by the way he was treated, and he needed to make more money because he had three kids. he left. Apollo raced on without him. And from that moment forward, really, I have to say, for the rest of his life, was a struggle for credit.
But I got to say, though, I mean, you know, as Americans, we tend to put more, you know, emotional constant on what we saw on TV. You know, that moment where the eagle lands. So that's visceral. It's visible. We can see it. It's got an emotional connection. We may have appreciated NASA writ large, but the idea of the American public going, oh, that's my favorite scientist now. Like, we just weren't there.
No. In some cases we were, though. Back in 1960, Wernher von Braun was famous. He was world famous. He was on the cover of Collier's magazine. He was doing Disney specials in primetime. He was buddies with John Kennedy. Now, von Braun is one example. Not all NASA engineers are going to be in this position, of course. It's true that John Hobel's not different from other engineers in the sense that they don't have popular recognition. But even within NASA, even within his own colleagues, the people he worked with, the people who do know better, and historians, John felt like he was never given even the professional credit that he deserved. And he felt like a lot of people came out of the woodwork in the later years to make sure that he didn't get the credit that he deserved because he came in sideways and he tried to upset the system.
Here's another view from inside NASA in terms of the way things worked then. And this is another interview in the audiobook. This is a clip of Roger Lepsch, who is an aerospace engineer who designs space vehicles at Langley, where John Hobel worked.
A lot of times with the way things work out, you know, with the bureaucracy, like you mentioned, inertia in the organizations, momentum that gets built up on certain things, it appears they're not doing the right things. You know, the agency's not doing it. And you feel this helplessness in a way that it's getting stuck. You know, you're going to get stuck down this certain road, and it wasn't the best one to take. And I don't know what to do about that personally, you know, other than to do kind of what Hobolt did, and which is, you know, it's a tough thing to take on in my mind. I mean, there's certain people that I think are strong enough willed to do it. I don't know if I'm one of those people, unfortunately, to be able to take that on, just trying to be honest with you.
That's aerospace engineer Roger Lepsch from the audiobook The Man Who Knew the Way to the Moon. Todd, it sounds like what he's saying is that the ability to break out of this groupthink is something that even scientists on supercritical missions deal with. I guess on the outside, you would think, you know, maybe we've been watching Armageddon too many times when it airs over and over on cable, but you would think that, like, everybody throws their ideas into the pot and then we assess all of them and the smartest people get that. But NASA was a very human organization. In
absolutely. And there's Roger Lepsch and his other Langley colleagues giving voice to the enormity of what John did. Really one of the highlights of this story, when John was campaigning and fighting to be listened to about Lunar Orbit Rendezvous, nobody's listening to him. He's getting politely dismissed. He's getting voted down in committee. He's got colleagues calling him a liar in front of other people. John gets very, very frustrated by this. He is actually very angry. He got very angry about this. And what he decided to do was to break ranks, to go outside. NASA wasn't just a bureaucracy, it was a hierarchy. This is a quasi-military organization. You have a good idea, as historian Bill Causey here in Washington, D.C. told me, you go to your boss, and if it's good enough, he goes to his boss. That's the way it worked then, and by the way, it was only he's back then. There weren't a lot of she's. Mm. John did something different. John got so desperate and so frustrated that he put together a 9-page grievance memo, in engineering speak, and sent it to the very top of NASA. He went 7 levels above his head to the number 3 guy at NASA, basically grabbing his lapels, saying, you need to listen to me. Everyone here is being stupid. I'm disgusted by the groupthink around here. This is a line he used to the number 3 guy at NASA, Joshua. Do we want to get to the moon or not? Huh? Basically, because if you don't, keep doing what you're doing. And if you do, you better listen to me. They had 2 reactions to that. One was, who the hell does this guy think he is? Call down there and get this Hobolt out. Get him in line. We don't do this in 1961 in NASA. We're conformists and we're military guys. We don't do this. Number 2 was, man, he's annoying. He's onto something. You know what? He might be right.
He might be right.
We better send this up and down the chain and reorganize everyone's thinking to see if this annoying Hobolt guy is onto something. And when that process starts, that's when NASA realizes, my God, John Hobolt's irritating, but he sure is right. And that's how we got to the moon.
Let's look forward a little bit. How much of John Hobolt's legacy remains at NASA today, either in the science that he brought forward or just his willingness to shake up the culture, to break the chain of command?
Well, it's fascinating because, according to the Trump administration, we're going back to the moon. Artemis is the new mission, named for Apollo's twin sister. So many of the people involved in Artemis, the face of NASA has changed. There's so many more women and young women involved. That's an encouraging thing to see. It was not the case in John Hobolt's day. But we're going back to the moon and then hopefully on to Mars. The mission mode debates. How do we get there? Do we use orbiting platforms like this thing NASA calls the Gateway? Should we use a Martian orbit rendezvous, or do we need lots of orbiting infrastructure? They're really having the exact same debates today. And the question for me is, yes, there will be some outsider idea that we'll have to fight to be heard. Like you said, it's a human endeavor. But has NASA learned the lesson that instead of shutting down those ideas and shoving them to the side, you can have an organization that fosters those ideas so that you don't have to go through months and years of unnecessary debate for the best ideas, which might come from the side, not from the hierarchy?
And do any of Hobolt's ideas help with that Mars mission, or is that a whole other kind of science?
No, they help. The ideas are much bigger because the distances are much greater and the mass is much greater, but the concepts don't change and the physics is the same. How much mass do you want to bring down to the surface? How are you going to push the mass back to get people home, unless they just want to live on Mars to the end of their days, in which case it's not such a big debate. But I don't think we're probably going to want to do that in the early days.
Not quite ready there. One more tweet from Patrick, who writes, one of my first words, as my mom relates, was moon. My uncle helped develop the Apollo computers, and I remember at 12 and a half watching those ghostly images on July 20th. Todd Zwillick is the author of the new audiobook, The Man Who Knew the Way to the Moon. It is on Audible. Todd, thanks for talking to us.
Great to be here, Joshua. Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we'll switch gears and talk about a new podcast that shines a light on tribal land rights in Oklahoma. The host of the podcast, This Land, joins us in a moment. Stay close.